This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Good morning. Opponents of the downtown Milwaukee streetcar project have said they're launching a petition drive to block any potential expansion of the project. That word came after a previous drive fell short of its goal amid questions about whether it would have carried legal weight in any case. But even with plans for the first phase of the streetcar moving forward, even many supporters say the project really only represents the tip of the iceberg when it comes to addressing the challenges of transit in the Milwaukee area. They point to a new study set to examine the idea of bus rapid transit in the region as another significant step forward. But they also say that the experiences of some other Midwestern cities represent some important models that Milwaukee would be well served to study, places including Minneapolis and Cleveland, each of which boast multiple modes of public transit. David Frank is the Director of Economic Policy and Development for the City of Minneapolis. He was previously the city's Director of Transit. Mike Shipper is the Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority's Deputy General Manager for Engineering and Project Management. They were both panelists at a recent forum on transit, which was moderated by Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. Also on the panel were Rob Henkin, President of Milwaukee's Public Policy Forum, and Linda Gorenz-Levy, a partner at Milwaukee-based General Capital Group. Mitch began by asking David Frank about the effort it took to bring the rest of Minnesota on board with its largest city's plans.
Remember, what we're talking about here is giving local jurisdictions and counties permission to impose taxes on their own, except that our light rail funding formula for, let's say, a $1 billion project, that's what the one between Minneapolis and St. Paul cost, is that 10% of that number comes from the state. So we are asking for support from the state general fund, typically, for that amount of money. And so far, we have not come up with it for the third line, that one I talked about that's a little over budget. But otherwise, we're asking for state support for local or jurisdictions to impose taxes. And that's continuing to be a problem.
And in Cleveland?
In Cleveland, it's a little different situation because our champion of the project was a man named George Voinovich, who was the mayor, and he dusted off kind of some of those plans in the 90s to get it going again. He became governor, and when he was governor, he pledged 20% of the project through one of the DOT mechanisms. And then when he became senator, then he worked on our behalf for earmarks, those nasty things that we don't have anymore. So he worked on earmarks, but he also helped us through the full funding grant agreement process. So our project was basically 50% Federal Transit Authority, 25 to 30% ODOT, and the rest of it from the local community. There is a local community piece to all these projects. So we put in money, the city put in money, and our local Metropolitan Planning Organization put in money. So it's a combination. It's many layered funding.
Let's stay with Cleveland for just a moment. And you mentioned in your presentation that Euclid Avenue kind of went untouched for 50 years or so. What did it take to go from doing nothing to doing something?
Well, it took a lot of disinvestment, and it took a lot of waterline breaks, and it took a lot of bad utilities, and it took a lot of people deserting the street until, you know, what once was Millionaire's Row was a street that really there wasn't that much traffic on. We benefited from that because then it made it a lot easier for us to put the center lane BRT in the middle because there wasn't that much traffic.
So you'd recommend a catastrophe.
No, actually, you know, in our lessons learned, I mean, there's a couple things. You can follow us and spend 50 or 60 years messing around, or you can figure out how to get a project that you can actually finance, fund, and build. It goes a lot faster. And finally, in our community, we were not going to finance a subway. We were not going to finance a light rail. And people really didn't like the do nothing of our number 6 bus line. So we massaged the project. Our project at one time was $350 million. We did it for $200 million. And we figured out how to do it, how to meet the federal requirements, how to meet the ODOT requirements, and how to get the local community to support that and be champions for it. So there's a lot of effort in there, but the subway or nothing, if you can't, any project, if you can't fund it, it ain't going to get built. And that's a big lesson. You have to finally come up with what you can actually do. And in this climate, that's hard.
Rob Henkin, how important do you think a magic number is to start the debate?
Well, we've been struck for months by the similarity between the Cleveland BRT line and what we might look at doing here. Our East-West corridor, another example, thankfully not as depressed as Euclid Avenue was, but we've been debating whether to do commuter rail or light rail in that corridor since the early 1990s. We've done nothing. And so is it time to consider what so many cities across the country are doing, which is to look at bus rapid transit? And I could sit here and argue to you that bus rapid transit is not as effective as light rail. But the fact is, it's a heck of a lot less expensive, and it's a way to introduce that rapid transit element that, again, might capture the public's imagination about the potential of mass transit. And so in terms of a magic number, Mitch, I don't have one. The problem with bus rapid transit is that while less expensive than rail, it's still very expensive. Now, there are federal programs out there. There's something called the Small Starts Program. There's something called the New Starts Program. There's something called the Tiger Program, though I know we're seeking funds for the streetcar under that program. But we've never really put on the table a plan to devote a dedicated lane to buses going east-west, costing that out and going to Washington and see how far we could get. And particularly with years and years of east-west corridor reconstruction already underway and about to hit us even more harshly, is there an opportunity to go to the state of Wisconsin and say, as part of their mitigation budget, to perhaps devote some dollars to a line like that? And I think it's very encouraging to hear that the county executive is now pursuing this. I know he's talking with the mayor. So encouraging to hear the mayor talking about this. We have the mayor of Wauwatosa here and the Common Council president, and I know they're excited about the possibility, the head of the Milwaukee Regional Medical Center. I think the cards are starting to align.
Well, hang on to the microphone for another second. You offered some definitions of the various forms of rapid transit out there. I was hoping you might be able to help us with another definition. What is the difference between the regional body, sewer pack, that exists in southeastern Wisconsin and the regional bodies in other places, the regional transit authorities, such as the ones that we've heard about today?
Well, for fear of having Ken Yunker stand up and tell me I got it wrong, I think the big difference, one of the big differences is teeth. Our Regional Planning Commission is empowered to plan. Our Regional Planning Commission is empowered to distribute certain pools of federal money. In other places, there are regional planning commissions that have even more power to actually implement. And I know it's been a frustration for Ken and Sewer Pack for many, many years that they developed some very strong regional transportation plans with some very far-reaching solutions, but they can't take it much further. And so I think that's one of the distinctions.
At the risk of asking all of my questions before we get to any of your questions, we have a question in the corner of the room.
It seems to me that Wisconsin Avenue has been the historical center of Milwaukee, and it's very similar to the Euclid Avenue number 6 line, and that's where the ridership has been strong. When I look at this map up here, I think a lot of the opposition has been that this is not a major transit route. Any comments on that?
Sure. Can developing Wisconsin Avenue from a transit standpoint, could that be a catalyst for that, the way Euclid Avenue perhaps worked in Cleveland?
Well, the original light rail proposal, if you recall the map that I put up there, the plan was to use that as an impetus for redevelopment of the 27th in Wisconsin and 35th in Wisconsin areas, which have now undergone some redevelopment, but I dare say it would have happened a heck of a lot more quicker if we had ever pulled the trigger at that time. The East-West corridor is our most heavily traveled transit corridor. It's the area in which we have the most intersecting bus routes. And it is our premise that that fact, coupled again with the many, many years of highway reconstruction, make that the ideal corridor to get started if the engineering works and if the cost-benefit works.
We heard a lot and talked a lot about the idea of rapid transit being what it takes for millennials to want to locate someplace. What has been your experience in terms of the demographics of who's been attracted to these transit-oriented developments in Cleveland and in Minneapolis?
Let's see. So I mentioned in my remarks a few minutes ago that I want to break this into two categories. There are employers who realize that in order to attract the workers they will need, they, the employers, have to locate near transit. And those employers, just the couple I mentioned a few minutes ago, large healthcare and sort of health tech employers in the southwestern suburbs of the Twin Cities who have said, the people I need, who might not even live in Minnesota or the Midwest right now, in order to come here, need to have the real choice not to get in their car. And I try to say this in my local presentations all the time, and I might suggest it's a good way to talk about it. We're not trying to force anyone to get out of their car. We want to make it a choice for more people not to have to. I see a bike helmet over there, right? The more people who can have that choice, the more that employer thinks that they'll be able to attract the workers of tomorrow. So that my tomorrow is hinting at my answer. The other thing I'd say is residential developers, both condominiums and apartments, are seeing that and they are mostly millennials, although some empty nesters, especially for buildings along transit, along our bikeway system, our trails are amazing, you should really come visit and borrow a bicycle, that those consumers of housing, renters and condominium buyers, are not looking for that second parking space. And to that first one, they're saying, can I pay you a la carte, you know, not included in my rent, so that if I get rid of my one car because the bus or the light rail or whatever works so well, I don't have to pay you for it anymore, and the developers are noticing and building less parking.
In Cleveland, the two fastest growing neighborhoods in Cleveland are downtown and University Circle, basically the two ends of our line. In downtown, our downtown population has gone from 2,500 to 12,000, and it's going to go to 25,000 by 2020 because we're already almost 100% occupied at the 12,000 level. So we have a lot of new, some office buildings are actually being converted into condos, and with the historic tax credits, a lot of those old buildings are being converted into apartments. What the Healthline did for us, it made it viable to live downtown and work in University Circle or work in Shaker Heights or work in other places on a reverse commute and even drive to work in a reverse commute, which is at least you're not going with the traffic, you're going against it. So in University Circle, when I showed the slide of the redevelopment there, they're really capitalizing on graduate students, medical residents, and fellows from the two hospitals and the graduate students at Case Western Reserve that also can be very, very close to work, but they can hop on the health line and come downtown and have fun and enjoy the restaurants and the sports and all the other things that we have. So the health line has been huge in that. Similar to that, we also have a trolley system. So if you look at your streetcar map, we have a similar thing that we have two trolley routes, rubber tire trolleys, which helps our downtown circulation. And it allows people that normally aren't bus riders to hop on a trolley and then tie into Tower City or tie into the Healthline. And all of a sudden, they're like, you know, this isn't too bad. And it's really augmented that downtown population spike that we're seeing. When we had the number 6 bus line, our demographic was 88% of those riders were transit dependent. When we opened the Healthline, and all of a sudden our ridership increased by first 40% and now 60%, our demographic of transit dependents only 50%, because the people that increase in ridership was not the transit dependent people. It was the choice riders that now could conveniently get either from their homes to work or work to school, or even downtown workers like myself, that if you have a doctor's appointment, instead of taking your car out and trying to park at the Cleveland Clinic, it's a lot faster to hop on the health line and go to the doctor and hop on the health line and go back to your office. So our midday ridership on the health line, we don't have the two spikes that you normally see. AM peak, drop off, PM peak. We have an AM peak, we drop off about 10% and it stays up all day. And then we have a little PM peak and then it kind of tails off at night. because we have a lot of choice users that are using it in the middle of the day, and they're not transit dependent. They wear suits like I do. They wear lab coats, and they ride with the transit dependent people because it's very convenient, fast, and easy.
And a question over here.
Have any of you considered doing adjustable transit to clusters of need, education, medical, and jobs, which might also require a change by employers or educators, hospitals, for example, and businesses for scheduling? For example, St. Luke's Hospital, we have a lot of household workers. They don't have to come in at 7 o'clock in the morning. They could come in at 9 o'clock. For example, education, we don't have to start at 7. We could start at 9 o'clock and adjust the things that way and make it improve our transportation for far less money.
I would say I have, yes, I've seen some local examples of it. I've not seen it in an organized way. I have seen private employers who have chosen to do it, school districts who have chosen to do it. Perhaps it was in the news here some years back when one of our interstate bridges unfortunately fell down. We saw a lot of it then because to reroute, I don't remember, 100,000 people a day around that was going to significantly tax the local road system as well as the transit network. And so some local employers did it, yes. I have not seen a central clearinghouse of you do it then and you do it then. I have not.
Let me maybe reframe the question a little. Is talking about this in terms of alleviating traffic alone the key issue, or is that a red herring?
Well, that's exactly the point that I was going to make. I think it depends on what problem you're trying to solve. Here we are very fortunate that traffic congestion is not a huge problem. It's certainly a growing problem, particularly in our east-west corridor. Actually, it's plateaued, but it's arguably a problem for a short period of time for the morning commute and the afternoon commute in the east-west corridor. Really, our fundamental problem, or at least one of the top, is this disconnect between central city job seekers and suburban jobs. And I would submit to you that just as we are considering, whether rightly or wrongly, hundreds of millions of dollars of additional investment to expand highway capacity in our east-west corridor to improve the commute for the Brookfield commuter by 5 minutes each way, we ought to be thinking about how to improve the quality of transit that might make a difference in terms of allowing that single mom who has to drop her kid off at daycare an opportunity to still use a fast and effective transit system to get to a job in Brookfield or New Berlin in a reasonable amount of time.
We have another question in that side of the room.
First of all, thank you for coming to Milwaukee. You guys are from wonderful cities, and I've always appreciated my visits there. But you raised a couple of points which I think are missing in Milwaukee. One is the support of the business community. And what I heard from the two of you, I think, was strong support from the business community, enough so you got over the hump. And the second part that Rob left out of his excellent presentation is the death of our regional transit authority. And if you could expound on the importance of authorities, I'd appreciate that.
I think on any big infrastructure project, it's not, you cannot rely on the transit authority and the general manager of the transit authority to be the champion for a transit project because it's too self-serving. Okay, we need other people. Yes, we want the project, but these projects, because of the size, whether it's billions for their project, a couple hundred for mine, they become community projects, and there's so much community outreach. But we do need the business community to be kind of a buffer between us and the political units because, whether it's Ohio Department of Transportation or Federal Transit Administration, that corporate support of a community project is huge where they, use their leverage and power to kind of blur the, whether it's a R or a D, and say, look, this is an investment in our community. Our community needs this. And some of us support you, and some of us support you, and some of us support both of you. So we need help. And it's huge. And it was very instrumental for the Healthline, especially in the days of the earmarks, because you needed that. So we had a line item for the Healthline for $25 million. Well, that $25 million was going to come whether we had a full funding grant agreement or not. But that $25 million, it got a lot easier to get the full funding grant agreement because then the FTA didn't have to pledge that much more to provide the funding. So, transit funding you know, we could spend hours talking about it. It's very convoluted, but you need that corporate community and other champions out there, and not just the general manager of the transit authority promoting a project, because it's an investment in the whole community.
Let me ask one more question here. How do you figure out that leadership question? You know, you mentioned George Voinovich a couple of times. I mean, does it take a figure like that to make something happen? I mean, when you have a system where state and local and county and business leaders are sometimes all at odds with each other, how do you have this one single catalyzing figure emerge?
I forget how you phrased your question, but the answer is yes, you need that, right? I have had the great pleasure of sitting in the office of the person who's the answer to this question in Minneapolis-St. Paul many times over the past few years. And when somebody calls or stops by his office about anything, and I mean it, it might be about social service, it might be about bike connections, or it might be about transit, they can't help but notice that all the things on his wall are about transit. They can't help but notice that even before he answers their question, he's telling them what they're going to do to help him with transit at the legislature, transit funding, transit project, media, whatever. Yes, you absolutely have to have that. It helps if it's a long-time office holder, and if you know at the beginning, so you could ride that, especially when you knew was going to be governor and senator. That'd be awesome. Well,
yeah. Along those lines, you know, sometimes it takes more than one, because if you only have one champion, well, sometimes that champion isn't there. And projects get killed all the time. I mean, you guys saw it with the high-speed rail. We saw it with the high-speed rail in Ohio. You know, we had a change in leadership there. One governor wanted it. One didn't. Guess what? We don't got it. It's gone. So, and a lot of my counterparts across the country, you know, that's one thing where the timing is so important. I mean, you can be at 99% design and have an election and it's back on the shelf.
David Frank is the Director of Economic Policy and Development for the City of Minneapolis. Mike Shipper is Greater Cleveland Regional Transit Authority's Deputy General Manager for Engineering and Project Management. Rob Henkin is President of Milwaukee's Public Policy Forum. And Linda Gorenz-Levy is a partner at General Capital Group. They spoke with Mitch Tyke at a forum on regional transit and economic development, which was organized by the group MetroGo.